see the upside, or you can choose to see the downside. And even in preaching, there's an upside and downside, believe it or not. And I guess the downside, one of the things that I see as a downside to being a local preacher in a congregation as opposed to someone who teaches in a preacher school or in a Christian college, is that you don't really have the time to stop and just really dig into some things that you would like to. If I taught Romans in a setting where I could teach it every year, then I would learn something about it and be able to spend a lot more time as I would like to. But whenever you have to have, by the nature of it, a Sunday morning sermon, a Sunday night sermon, quite often two lessons during the week, and then sometimes a funeral or a wedding thrown in, and then sometimes other things happen, like park spins that take some time, then you don't get to stop and stay in places as long as you would want. It's kind of like the local preacher in the congregation is kind of like the general practitioner. He just has to know some about a lot of things and not necessarily a lot about very many things. And that's a little bit sad to me, because there are obviously things that you would like to stop and just spend lots and lots of time on. And we have been in a series of lessons that I've called the big picture, and we're winding that down. And I told you last time that we would wind it down with the destruction of Jerusalem and destruction of the temple. And that's something that has held quite a fascination for me for a long time. So all of the spare time that I've had this week, I added to what little I know about that. And so I've said all that to say, if things are a little bit disjointed tonight, then please bear with me. But because I wanted to, I spent a considerable amount of time digging into some of a little bit of the history of the temple. And Lord willing, because I want to, I'm going to spend one more lesson on it, because I want a little more time while I'm right here, and I know that opportunity may not come again. So my plan is for next Sunday night to end this series with talking about literally the destruction of the temple by the Romans. I don't know. I'm sure that everybody doesn't find this as fascinating as I do, but I really do think that there's a tremendous amount of the New Testament that becomes a lot more enjoyable and a lot clearer when you understand the setting that the Christians were living in at that time and what was happening with them, with the Roman Caesars, and what is about to happen historically. And so with having said all that, then I'm just warning you that this is just one lesson. It's a little bit disjointed and maybe a lot disjointed, I don't know. We'll see, but we'll end this, Lord willing, next time, talking about literally the destruction of the temple, because it is an incredibly fascinating time in the Jews' history. Right now, I want you to open your Bibles up to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24. I want to read with you. I'm going to start in verse 3. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. "Tell us," they said, "when will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" By the way, if you're reading from the King James Bible, then it says the end of the world. Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I am the Christ, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you're not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes. away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. Many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of in the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountain. Let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out of his house. Let no one in the field go back to get his clothes. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in the winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great distress, unequal from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. For the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. See, I have told you ahead of time. So if anyone tells you, there he is out in the desert, do not go out. Or here he is in the inner room, do not believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. What's he talking about? Well, look at the setting in verse 1 and 2. Jesus left the temple and he was walking away when his disciples came to him and called his attention to its buildings, the temple. Do you see all these things? He asked. I tell you the truth, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. And I made mention as I was reading through this, there in the end of verse 3, that the King James uses the word, the coming will be the end of the world. And that's unfortunate because many of us that grew up with the King James Bible, that's what we heard, and so this was quoted as the end of the world. But the word is aeon, and it means the end of this age. And so, if whenever you think about when did these things that we just read, and there's some more on that in this context, when did these things occur, or when will these things occur? And the answer is, they have already occurred. It was not, and is not, the Lord's final coming, or the end of the world. Otherwise, what in the world would be the meaning of these verses here in verse 16, if you're on your roof, don't go down and get anything. And woe to the women who are pregnant in those days, or who are nursing, because pray that your flight is not during cold weather, during the winter. What does all that have to do? Are you going to run? Are you going to come down from your house and run whenever the Lord comes back? This is not talking about the end of the world. It's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. There are, I believe, some secondary applications, just like as you go through the Old Testament and you find similar language to this, and if you'd like to be turning there, Isaiah chapter 13, we're going to look at that in just a moment. There has been similar language to this in the past. And if you go back and look at the context, and look at verse 29 particularly, the sun will be, and I'm still in Matthew while you're turning there to Isaiah 13, the sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. And that's one of the reasons, among others, that people say, well, this is talking about the end of time. Compare this language, this is called apocalyptic language, this language is what Isaiah said in chapter 13, beginning in verse 9. He said, "See, the day of the Lord is coming, a cruel day, with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land desolate and destroy the sinners within it. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their sin. I will put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and humble the pride of the ruthless. I will make people scarcer than pure gold, more rare than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble and the earth will shake from its place at the wrath of the Lord Almighty in the day of his burning anger." Now, if you go back and look at the context of Isaiah chapter 13, he specifically tells you what this is talking about. He's talking about a judgment against Babylonia. And he uses this kind of language, and he will also use the terminology, the day of the Lord. This is not the first, and here in Matthew, this is not the first day of the Lord. There have been other days of the Lord. A day of the Lord in the Old Testament was a time when the Lord came in with judgment on a nation. And it was something that happened in time, and it has happened a number of times, if you go back historically. In Isaiah chapter 34, another context where similar language is used, it says, "All the stars of the heaven will be dissolved, and the sky rolled up like a scroll. All the starry hosts will fall like withered leaves from the vine, like shriveled figs from the fig tree." And in that setting, he's talking about, it's the prophecy against Edom, and prophesying that the Lord is going to bring judgment on Edom. The reason being because whenever the Babylonians came and took captives, then there were some of the captives who fled to the south and they went to their brother Edom. And Edom either turned them away or turned them over to the Babylonians or they themselves took them as slaves. And so the Lord said, "I'm going to bring a judgment on Edom because of that." And he used that kind of language. And so we come to the New Testament, and if all you've ever studied is your New Testament, you had to study your Old Testament and put some historical context to it, then it's pretty easy for you to think, well, anytime you see this language where it talks about the sun being dark and the moon being turned to blood and the stars falling from the sky, that that's talking about the end of time. And quite often that's the only application that we have made. And let me once again say that I believe that there is an application to the end of time, because that will be the judgment. But there have been other judgments in time. Some of the history of the temple in Jerusalem, and understand that the destruction that's about to happen here in the New Testament, that Jesus is talking about here in Matthew chapter 24, is not the first time that the temple has been destroyed. If you go back historically, and you will likely remember that the original temple built by Solomon stood for over 350 years until the third time that King Nebuchadnezzar came back to deport people from Jerusalem. And that setting is in 2 Kings chapter 25. And it tells about the first destruction of the temple. And let me read just a little bit of it so that you'll have this in your mind. Beginning in chapter 24, verse 18, is the beginning of the story of the third deportation. Nebuchadnezzar comes one time, he carries away captives. Among those captives, a young man by the name of Daniel. That sets the stage for the book of Daniel. He comes back a second time because the people rebel against him and refuse to pay taxes. He comes back, carries away many more captives, takes a lot of the gold and so forth from the temple. Among the captives this time is a man by the name of Ezekiel. That sets the backdrop for the book of Ezekiel. And then in the days of Zedekiah, and if you have your chart that I gave you of the kings and the prophets, and you go and you find Zedekiah, and there you'll find out that Zedekiah is the very last king. There won't be any more kings in Judah or Israel from this time on. There will be governors, but there won't be any more kings. Nebuchadnezzar will come back a third time, and this this time, Zedekiah the king, Jeremiah has prophesied. You'll remember that the king is going to have his eyes put out, his sons are going to be slain before his eyes, and that very thing takes place. And you pick up now in verse chapter 25, now Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. I'm in 2 Kings 25:1. So in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Jerusalem with his whole army. He encamped outside the city, built siege works all around it. The city was kept under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah, by the ninth day of the 4th month. So if you go back and do your math, almost 18 months that the army, Babylonian army, has surrounded the city, cut off all of their food supply. By the ninth day of the 4th month, the famine in the city had become so severe that there was no food for the people to eat. Then the city wall was broken through, and the whole army fled at night through the gate between the two walls near the king's garden. Though the Babylonians were surrounding the city, they fled toward the Arabah, which would be south of the Dead Sea. But the Babylonian army pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho. All his soldiers were separated from him and scattered, and he was captured. He was taken to the king of Babylon at Riblah, where a sentence was pronounced on him. They killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. They put out his eyes, bound him with bronze shackles, and took him to Babylon. On the 7th day of the 5th month, the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guards, an official of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. He set fire to the temple of the Lord, the royal palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem. Every important building he burned down. The whole Babylonian army, under the command of the imperial guard, broke down the walls around Jerusalem. Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guard, carried into exile the people who remained in the city, along with the rest of the populace and those who had gone over to the king of Babylon. But the commander left behind some of the poorest people of the land to work the vineyards and the fields. And then he begins in verse 13 all the way through 17, and he tells about how they stripped the temple. And they got everything of any value down, and they completely destroyed everything else. They pushed it down. They burned everything that was burned. They pushed all of the stones down. The temple was completely destroyed all the way down to its foundation. And then verse 18 through 22 will tell about that he also took the high priest, he took the chief priest, he took all the important people of the land. He killed, he executed all of them. And then in verse 23, he appointed Gedaliah as governor, and there won't be any more kings from this time on. And then he goes on down and tells how that the people didn't like Gedaliah, so they assassinated him. And then they fled because of they assassinated the governor that the Babylonian king had put over a responsible position over them. They fled to Egypt. And if you go back to Jeremiah, by the way, this is a little aside here. Jeremiah didn't want to go with them, but they forced him to go with them. And they took Jeremiah to Egypt with them against his will. So that provides you a little background of the destruction of the first temple. At the end of 70 years of Babylonian captivity, the city and the temple will lay in ruins for 70 years. And at the end of that 70 years, the temple will be rebuilt by Zerubbabel. And you remember that story in the first 6 chapters of Ezra. That will be as the Old Testament is coming to an end. Zerubbabel came back, the first return to rebuild the temple. Ezra came back to restore the law. That story is told in the last 6 chapters of Ezra. And then you have the story of Nehemiah coming back and rebuilding the wall. And that is the close of the Old Testament. That's where the Old Testament comes to an end. And so for 200 years, now there is a temple standing once again, rebuilt by Zerubbabel and those who were with him. For 200 years, approximately, during the intertestamental period, that temple will stand until the Greek, and it will continue to stand after this, but there is a historic event that really affects the Jews and the temple. And that is the Greek Seleucid king Antiochus Epiphanes that will come and loot the temple. And we told that story back a few weeks ago. He erected a statue of Zeus and put it in the temple itself. outlawed Jewish worship, and it became an offense that was punishable by death to own the Pentateuch, or the Jewish Bible. And so he tried to completely stamp out all the Jewish religion. They could not come to the temple. They could not use the temple. The temple had been defiled. But soon, under the Maccabean leadership, some of you will remember some of that story, the Jews gained independence. And in that independence, they cleansed and rededicated the temple and restored worship. And by the way, the Jews still commemorate this occasion in their yearly 8-day celebration that's called Hanukkah. And it is also called, in the New Testament, the Festival of Lights. And if you want to see a backdrop for that, you can go to John chapter 10, because that Jesus was there in Jerusalem in the observation of Hanukkah, that they had cleansed the temple. It was Josephus said it became the most holy day of all for the Jews. But the temple, that temple will remain, having been cleansed now, until 19 B.C., just shortly before Christ is born, when Herod the Great began a renovation project which would involve tearing the temple down and rebuilding. In Jesus' time, even as an adult, the temple was still under construction. This temple that was begun 20 plus years before he was born. That temple was still under construction. In John chapter 2, verse 20, Jesus had made the statement that if you tear this temple down, I'll rebuild it in 3 days. And so they came back and said, you know, in essence, are you crazy? It has taken 46 years to build the temple back to what it is today. And you say that you're going to rebuild it in 3 days. And of course, they're going to use that as an accusation against him later. But that project that was begun in 19 B.C. will not be completed until 60 A.D. So you can figure that out. It was approximately 80 years in the building. Josephus writes that the basic structure of the temple and its immediate courtyards were completed actually in 9.5 years. But the rest of that time was spent finishing it up. And if you've ever built a house before, you know that sometimes it seems like it takes that long to get, you know, the essentials done, and then you slow down on some of it. But the interesting thing is, it took almost 80 years to rebuild that temple. Just barely 10 years after it was completed, Titus is going to destroy it. And it's going to be an incredibly magnificent structure. In 20 B.C., Herod announced that the old temple would be torn down and it would be replaced by the one that was truly magnificent. If you would, put that first slide up for us, if you would, please. The Jewish priesthood, when he announced that he was going to tear the old temple down and rebuild it much better, they didn't really trust him. They wanted a much better temple than what was there. And so they finally agreed with the stipulation that he would quarry all of the stones required for the project and that they would be on site before he ever tore the old one down. And so they thought that he would start and never be able to completely finish it. So they said, we want all the materials on site here before you tear it down. So he agreed. It was Herod's plan that the entire mountain, Mount Moriah, would be turned into a giant square platform, the Temple Mount. The outer walls were built around the base of the Temple Mount, starting from the lowest point. The blocks were fastened to one another with lead. And Josephus says that on the inside they put iron clamps were used to clamp the blocks together on the inside, giving the outer walls greater strength. When the wall reached the designated height, then obviously there was space. The higher it went, the more space there was between it and the top of the mountain. And so they filled in to those retaining walls so that a level surface for the temple complex. Some of these blocks at the very base of the wall, many of them weigh over 100 tons. The largest one measuring 40, or the largest one uncovered so far, measuring 44 and a half feet by 11 feet by 16 and a half feet, weighing approximately 600 tons. King Herod called in architects from Greece and Rome and Egypt to plan the construction. The blocks were quarried. They were carved into precise squares. They were numbered at the quarry to show where they would be installed. And as the mountainside began to rise, the western wall was carved away to form a vertical wall to use as landfill on the northern side. The project began with the building of a giant underground vault under the temple so that the temple would not be just that area on top of the mountain, but it would also include a large number of vaults beneath it. The courtyard. Now, I take this from Josephus' writings. The temple had four courts, each with restrictions on who could enter. The outer court was open to everyone, including Gentiles. The second court, all Jewish men and ritually pure Jewish women could enter. The third court, ritually pure Jewish men alone could enter. And the fourth court, priests who were properly attired come in. And only the high priest dressed in his high priestly raiment could enter into the sanctuary proper. Additionally, the Mishnah distinguished degrees of holiness. And I thought this was interesting in view of Jesus' conversation about which is more holy, the gold in the temple or the temple itself. And he had that conversation with the Jews. But the Mishnah describes the holiness is possessed by various areas of the temple. The temple mount was holier than the city. The terrace surrounding the inner courts was holier than the temple mount. The court of women is holier than the terrace. The court of the Israelites, the men, is holier than the court of the women. And finally, the court of the priests is the holiest of all. And so they had this in their thinking process, as they would swear by the gold in the temple and various things. The temple itself was an incredible structure, and this is a reproduction of it. And I put this up because I want you to understand that this was no small feat. This was not an insignificant structure. This is the Western Wall. Some of you have been there. The Western Wall actually, when it was originally built, was taller than that. Not that it was taller on the top, it was taller on the bottom. Because since its original building, the ground level has been brought up. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the wall itself, if you were standing at the base of the wall when it was originally built, you would have been considerably lower than where people are today. So you see how tall that wall is. Let me give you a rendition. This is someone who has a computer program, and they have reconstructed the temple as it would have looked in Jesus' time. Just so that you'll see, this was two underground gates called the Huldah Gates that you could go into the temple there, or at least some certain people were allowed to go there. You see, this is an incredibly massive structure. This is the southwest corner of the temple. Can you see why the Jews were proud of this? It was one of the most magnificent structures in the world. This would have been on the outside of one of the courts. And then this is just an artist's rendition of the siege of destruction of Jerusalem. The temple itself was an incredible structure. The entire sanctuary was wider in the front. It had, in essence, we would call a false front on it. The front was 150 feet by 150 feet, and it was covered with pure gold. Now, think about what this meant. Think about the pride that they would have had in it. Think about what that structure would have looked like sitting on a mount above the city there. The entire sanctuary was wider in the front, and then it was narrower behind. The width of the building behind this portico front was 90 feet instead of 150 feet, but it was 150 feet deep behind it. As I said, the face was covered with plates of pure gold, which at the rising of the sun reflected a splendor that made it impossible to look directly at. From a distance, it stood in sharp contrast with the city because the structure of the temple itself was made of white marble. And so you think about that white marble structure sitting on the mount there, the front of it covered with pure gold. It was topped with peaks that were so sharp by design that a bird couldn't sit on it. And that was so that birds could not defile it with their droppings. Now, stop just a minute. Do you remember anything that happened on the highest peak of the temple? The devil took Jesus there. And he said, if you'll throw yourself down from here, then I'll give you everything you want. And they were on the highest peak, one of those high peaks of the temple. The Holy of Holies contained absolutely nothing during this time, because the things that originally inhabited were no longer there. So I told you to be a little disjointed, and my ending will be a little abrupt here, but I want you to go back now, and I want you to listen to a couple of verses. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came to him and called his attention to its building. Do you see all these things? He asked. I tell you the truth, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. And he will say in verse 33, I'm back in Matthew 24, even so, when you see all these things, you will know that the end is near, right at the door. I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my word will never pass away. Really interesting, at least to me, how much confidence the Jews put in the temple during Jesus' time. The fact that the temple was still standing, to me it's kind of a parallel to what they did back during Eli's time. You remember when they lost the battle to the Philistines and they said, hey, let's bring the Ark of the Covenant in the battle, and they lost it, you remember? But they put their confidence in the fact that it was there. And we always want to put we always want something that we can hear and see and smell and touch and taste, don't we? And in all of this, and when we think about this structure being, and we're going to talk about this, Lord willing, next time, about this structure and how it was destroyed. And there are some really ironic things about it. One of them is that Titus, the Roman general, who was responsible at that time, he did everything within his power to not destroy that temple. He didn't want to destroy that temple. And he tried, even after all of the months and months and months that it took, and all of the cost that it took the Romans to take the city, he tried to keep his soldiers from destroying that temple. But they got out of control. They were so hostile and so angry when they finally got in that city, if they killed everybody they could kill and looted everything they could loot. And they set the temple on fire. But it was because the Jews refused, even after they broke into the city, they refused. They kept fighting down to the very, very end. Because this structure meant so much to them. And I find it really interesting throughout history how often God tells us and warns us, here's the way I want you to live. This is what I want you to do. And if you don't live this way, I'm going to punish you. And that punishment has been the only hope that we have. Because as long as we think we can stand on our own, then we're going to have our way. And we're going to make our own decisions, and we're not going to change our course until something happens in our life. I don't want destruction to have to come into my life or to my family's life in order for God to get the message from me. I want my heart to be more quiet. But I really think that if we're not careful, we can find ourselves in that same bank that they did. And so, the message in all of this, and the instruction